Good morning. Our next and last matter on the oral calendar today is State of Minnesota versus Simon Benjamin Donqua, court file A18-1581. I'm sure counsel here is fully familiar with our procedures. You know you both have 15 minutes for your principal arguments, and appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. And feel free to adjust the podium to your comfort. With that, identify yourselves for the record when you begin your arguments, and counsel for appellant, you may proceed.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Benjamin Butler. I'm an assistant state public defender. I represent the appellant, Simon Donqua. This court must reverse Mr. Danqua's conviction because it was based on inadmissible evidence and prosecutorial misconduct. I'd like to address both issues this morning, if I may, beginning with Mr. Danqua's accuser's inconsistent out-of-court statements. I think the respondent and I have a fundamental disagreement about what the word consistent means for the purposes of this rule, the rule allowing prior consistent statements, what the word consistent means. The respondent's position seems to be that as long as the two statements are not directly contradictory and they're about basically the same thing, then they're consistent. And that, I think, is simply not true. And the Minnesota Supreme Court's decision in Farah and the comment to the rule tells us that if the two statements are about purportedly the same thing, or the same set of things. But one statement contains information not contained in the second statement. I'm not necessarily basing this on time, which is first, which is second, doesn't matter. In this case, the first set of statements chronologically contain tons more information and more accusations than are contained in the second statement, which is the trial testimony. And when that's the case, Farah tells us that the statements are not consistent, and the out-of-court statement is not admissible, because the whole purpose of the prior consistent statement rule is the common sense proposition that when someone says something, makes an accusation one time, and then makes the same accusation a second time, that seems to lend credibility to the initial accusation, to both accusations. But where the accusations are different, materially different, different in kind. I agree they don't have to be verbatim, and obviously there are lots of cases saying they don't have to be verbatim, and I don't think saying, adding this kind of information that's at issue here is suggesting a rule that they have to be verbatim, they have to be identical. They don't have to be identical. But they do have to be consistent. They do have to be the same. And where they're not, the fact that they are not directly contradictory does not mean that they're consistent. Now, in this case, the declarants, O.S. and U.S., made a number of statements out of court before they got to court, and the vast majority of those statements are inconsistent, or I put it a different way, are not consistent with their trial testimony, because their trial testimony, particularly O.S., and O.S. is the alleged victim in counts 1 through 3, particularly O.S., the trial testimony was very basic. OS's only accusation in court of sexual abuse was that Mr. Danqua put pepper in her vagina and touched the inside of her vagina. She made that very, very blandly as part of testimony. Her out-of-court statements are nothing close to that. Her out-of-court statements include that Mr. Danqua threatened her with a large black sharp knife when he did that.
I don't see that they have the same elements. I mean, pepper and the threat with the knife.
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I didn't follow that.
What I'm trying to ask you is that they have different elements as far as what would be required to prove up the accuracy of that statement. I mean, they don't seem to be related at all.
They're not. They're not related at all, Your Honor. And that's why the knife statement isn't admissible. I mean, one of the problems here is that the district court did not go through these reams of out-of-court statements either to Cornerhouse or in OS's case, and I agree with the state.
The court indicated that it had read all of those statements. So that's what my review of the record was.
Well, it certainly didn't do so on the record, and nor did on the record it detailed which statements were consistent and which weren't, which is what the case law says you should do, because otherwise you allow a few consistent statements to bootstrap in a whole bunch of out-of-court inconsistent statements. To Dr. Harper, for example, OS told Dr. Harper that Mr. Danqua had touched her vagina with his penis, that his penis had touched her mouth and lips, and that he actually penetrated her vagina with his penis. She didn't come anywhere near saying anything like that during her trial testimony. I believe she testified when asked about Mr. Danqua's genitalia that she didn't remember. That's not consistent. That's not the same thing as saying it happened. That's not even close to the same thing. And that's what we would allow it as impeachment evidence if the defense wanted to impeach her, which of course they did not, because they don't want the out-of-court statements, which are much more damaging than the in-court
Counsel,
statements coming in at all.
How does the fact that there's OS and US are children affect our analysis, if at all?
Almost none, Your Honor. The fact that they're children may give them some leeway in terms of holding them to a really high standard of consistency. So in other words, if my claim was, well, you said it happened on a Saturday, in trial you said it happened on a Saturday, but in your prior statement you said it happened on a Sunday, that's not consistent. There's evidence in the record to say, look, children don't think linearly, they don't always know what day it is, things like that. I think that would be fair. But given the extent of the inconsistencies here, again, particularly with OS, the fact that she's a child doesn't make these statements, which are not consistent, which are not the same, consistent. It is not consistent to say on one level, the defendant helped us, quote-unquote helped, us take a bath, and that made us uncomfortable, which is OS alluded to that during her testimony, so did US. The out-of-court statement is, I was taking a shower, Mr. Danqua came in through a locked door, opened the shower curtain, dropped his pants, and wiggled his penis at me. Those two things are not consistent under any definition of the word consistent. And so that statement should never have come in. And there are reams, and I don't need to go through each one of them. They're all cited in the briefs. There are reams of individual statements like that throughout this trial.
So in objecting to your brief indicates that there was an objection to the use of these statements. But was there, I don't remember this, and so you can help me, Mr. Butler. Did counsel in the court go through these statements in any specific way, parsing out the ones that the defendant claimed were inconsistent and make arguments as to the relative inconsistency or the consistency of those, or was it a more of a blanket objection? These aren't consistent, so they shouldn't be played at all.
Both parties, Your Honor, treated it as a blanket objection. The defendant said none of them should come in, none of the statements, they're not consistent with the trial testimony. The state said all of it should come in. The district court just said all of it should come in. Now, I would argue the defense objects to all of it coming in. The government is the proponent of the statement. Of the evidence. And the proponent of the evidence bears the burden of showing the evidence's admissibility, bears the burden by the preponderance of the evidence, and that's a case called In Re Source Code, which I apologize is not cited in the brief. It's a Minnesota Supreme Court case, holding that the proponent bears the burden of proving by a preponderance the facts necessary to show admissibility of a particular piece of evidence. And in this case, those facts were consistency. So if the government, if the state thought there were particular statements that were particularly consistent with the trial testimony, that was on them to identify those for the district court and for the district court to make a decision about them. Because all the defense's obligation is simply to say, I don't think any of it should come in. And that's what the defense attorney did here for all of these statements, including the ones to Dr. Harper and the ones to Coroner House.
But yeah, and I agree with that, but When Judge Quam then said, well, I've reviewed all of them, and I think they're consistent enough, there wasn't any further objection. Well, Judge, what about the knife incident here? How is that at all consistent?
No, but there doesn't have to be, Your Honor. Judge Quam has issued a ruling. They're consistent enough, they're coming in. So I don't know of any authority for the proposition that the defense attorney then has to continue to argue with the district court judge who's made his decision about particular pieces of evidence or ask for reconsideration or any such thing. All he has to do is object, which he did, bring the matter to the attention of the trial judge, cite the relevant rule, which he did, and then say, make his argument, which is these aren't consistent. And if the trial judge thought they were consistent enough, well, then here we are. And this court reviews for abuse of discretion. I agree, that's the standard of review. There's some discretion to the trial judge here. But this court can look at the exact same evidence that Judge Quam looked at and say, well, there's no way that the bulk of these statements, again, the only thing OS testified to regarding the sexual abuse was put his finger inside my vagina with pepper in it. If she said that to Corner House or to Dr. Harper, then fine, that statement can come in. But nothing else about the sexual abuse is consistent with that accusation made at trial, because it adds all kinds of, not only does it add all kinds of evidence, but it's talking about completely different events. And the Minnesota Supreme Court says when the prior statement, in this case the Corner House or Dr. Harper statement, contains assertions about events not described in testimony, then those assertions are not helpful to determine the witness's credibility and are not admissible as substantive evidence under this rule. And again, this is, you can look at the black and white piece of paper and see these things are not consistent with the trial testimony. That's also true for U.S. I mean, U.S. made this to Corner House, U.S. made this bizarre accusation that the defendant had, quote, drilled, end quote, drilled through sheets and drilled into O.S.'s leggings. I'm not even sure what that means, but she certainly didn't testify to that. And so,
but you had a chance to cross-examine. You just elected as a part of your own trial strategy not to exercise that right.
Yeah, but the chance to...
But the judge even said you could show or demonstrate maybe these children were not reliable if you had cross-examined them.
But the cross-examination is, Your Honor, designed to deal with the evidence after it comes in. The defense's position is the evidence shouldn't have come in at all. And I shouldn't have to cross-examine the witness about to deal with harmful evidence, substantive evidence, against its accusations admitted against the defendant, and then say, oh, we're really just doing you a favor because you can use these to cross-examine her. I guess that could have been the trial strategy. It would have been an inept one, but it wasn't. The trial strategy here was, I want all of these this case should stand or fall on OS and US coming in, swearing to tell the truth, and accusing Mr. Danqua of whatever it is they're going to accuse him of. And if the jury believes their trial testimony, he's guilty. And if they don't, or if they have a reasonable doubt about it, he's not. That's what this case should have been. If the trial testimony had been more consistent with the out-of-court statements, then the out-of-court statements could come in as prior consistent statements. But it's not. And again, in the vast majority of the statements, it's not even close. And the evidence here, there's no way to say that these statements, which form the bulk of the state's closing argument, which are most of what the prosecutor talked about, and which are far more detailed and far more graphic and far more evocative than the trial testimony, was somehow harmless, did not significantly impact the jury's decision. The test is not, of course, was there otherwise sufficient evidence to support a verdict? That's not the harmless error test. The harmless error test is about impact. What was the impact of these particular pieces of evidence on the jury's decision? You look at them as a whole, not even taking each individual thing, oh, the jury could have disregarded the knife or the jury could have disregarded the drilling. The jury heard hours of videotaped, highly emotional evidence of these two young girls accusing the defendant of all manner of terrible, terrible physical abuse and sexual abuse, almost none of which was consistent with their trial testimony. That's not harmless. That's not the kind of trial. That's not the kind of error that a court should look at and say, they did come in and testify. Not given this testimony, not given the testimony they actually gave, and particularly not given the counts with regard to OS. because the counts with regard to OS counts 1, 2, and 3, OS's testimony was very, very bland. In 1 minute, I want to say two things about the misconduct argument, if I may. The primary problem with the misconduct argument is that it is not tied to the facts of this case. And we know it's not tied to the facts of this case because this county attorney's office, and I don't mean this as a personal attack, makes this word-for-word argument in child sex abuse cases all the time. They made it, there's at least three other cases pending before this court with this same argument, literally word for word, the beginning. Children speak quietly, so we have to listen to them. And then the problematic part is not so much about the children, because there's evidence about how children think and children speak. It's about the defendant. Men who prey on children. Men who prey on children want you to do X, Y, and Z. Men who prey on children think 1, 2, and 3. That's about the defendant. And there's no evidence, thankfully, because it would be inadmissible, of character evidence about the defendant or about people charged with sex abuses generally that would support that argument. It's a scripted argument. It's written ahead of time. It's given to the prosecutors to give. And it is misconduct because, among other reasons, it doesn't fit the facts of this case. Thank you, Your Honors. All
right, thank you, Mr. Butler. Counsel for respondent.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Nicole Cornell. I'm an assistant Hennepin County attorney on behalf of respondent, the state of Minnesota. I'd like to use my brief argument time this morning to address three important things. The district court properly admitted the child sex abuse victim's corner house statements in this case under Minnesota Rule of Evidence 801D1B because the victim's statements were reasonably consistent. The standard is reasonably consistent and not consistent to permit the jury to hear them. The standard of review here is an abuse of discretion, so the appellant has to prove an abuse of discretion in admitting the corner house statements and then also prove that he was prejudiced, and appellant failed on both aspects. The second thing I'd like to discuss is the prosecutor's statements in closing argument and in rebuttal did not constitute misconduct and had no effect on appellant's substantial rights. And the standard of review, appellant did not object at trial, so it's a modified plain error test, which again, appellant bears the burden to show that the statements were improper, and then the state bears the burden to prove that the appellant was not prejudiced thereby. And then briefly, appellant is not entitled to relief requested, and this court should affirm the convictions. With regard to appellant's interpretation of the standard as just consistent, that's incorrect. The standard is reasonably consistent. And this court has held multiple times that where a corner house statement of a child sex abuse victim includes more detail than what is testified to, that does not constitute inconsistent. Instead, this court has held that additional information in a corner house statement is reasonably consistent when you view it under the totality of circumstances. And I think that's what Judge Cochran was alluding to. So here in this case, credibility was clearly at issue. The victims did testify at trial. Appellant did have the opportunity to cross-examine both girls as to their corner house statements and chose not to. The district court clearly analyzed each statement. And that's clear from the record. It's true that the district court did redact some statements from the corner house video that did not regard the particular allegations of sexual abuse against the defendant in this case. The court also heard arguments on the issue from both the prosecutor and defense counsel. The court reviewed the entire corner house videos and the transcripts from them. And it's important to note that defense counsel did not suggest additional redactions when the district court asked defense counsel, do you have any other suggestions? I can leave this open if you have additional items you want redacted. So the district court encouraged defense counsel in that respect. And again, the district court did not abuse its discretion in finding that the statements were reasonably consistent. The court recognized, and so did appellant during oral this morning, that there are no such things as perfectly consistent statements. The considerations that the court gave was that the child sex abuse victims in this case are children. When they're on the stand, it's a completely different environment than that of Corner House when they're disclosing non-leading questions, discussing trauma in front of strangers, and in front of their alleged perpetrator. These are all important considerations that the district court appropriately applied in finding that these statements are reasonably consistent. Again, case law supports the district court's ruling here, specifically Enrique K.A.S., Zulu, Standifer, and Cochran. In all of those cases, this court has previously rejected similar arguments that appellant makes here regarding the admission of child sex abuse victims where the prior statement was more detailed than what was testified to. So but clearly,
is there a difference, counsel, between, I mean, the Supreme Court, as Mr. Butler references, does make a distinction, it seems, between statements that are more detailed and statements that are addressing issues that weren't addressed at all in the trial testimony. In the Farrah case, you know, the Supreme Court says when a witness's prior statement contains assertions about events that have not been described by the witness in the trial testimony, those assertions are not helpful in supporting the credibility of the witness and are not admissible under the rule. So, how do we draw that line between whether they're reasonably consistent and whether they're addressing subject matter that never came up during the trial testimony and that but for the Corner House interview, the jury never would have heard?
And, Your Honor, in response, Rule 801D1B does say that consistent statements can come in that are helpful to the trier of fact in evaluating the declarant's credibility as a witness. And in addition, in the Farrah case, the Supreme Court did not analyze those statements, I don't believe. The Supreme Court did not reach the prior consistent statement analysis in that case. And instead, the district court here did not abuse its discretion because it importantly analyzed the statements in context of when those statements were made and in context of what a child sex abuse victim experiences on the stand, and correctly concludes that those are reasonably consistent, especially in light of the Court of Appeals case law on this exact set of facts, that different but not inconsistent facts allow those Corner House statements to come in, as this court has repeatedly held. In addition, Your Honor, appellant has failed to show prejudice of the Corner House statements coming in. Specifically, there's one case where a defendant did show prejudice in the context of district courts admitting a Corner House video, but that is a case where the child said nothing on the stand and didn't accuse anyone of a crime. That is distinguishable from what happened in this case. The case I was referring to just now is the Hutto case, H-U-T-T-O. Additionally, appellant relies on the Bakken case. And in the Bakken case, it's important to note that the district court did not find, in Bakken, the court found that even where statements were not proved as prior consistent statements, meaning they weren't sufficiently consistent, that still did not constitute prejudice. And again, it's the appellant's burden to prove prejudice, and he didn't in that case. Additionally, the four cases I've previously cited that have similar facts to this case, the court correctly found that the two statements were consistent, reasonably consistent with each other, and the appellant failed to show prejudice. Briefly, Your Honors, I'd like to address the prosecutorial misconduct claim that appellant has brought. Appellant specifically cites to two different statements.
Let's spend some time, if you would please, and let's talk about using the comparing the defendant to an animal or prey. And, you know, this is, as was indicated, seems to come up quite a bit. We have unpublished cases but we don't say anything emphatically on that subject. You have an issue here where you didn't compare Donqua as someone that prays, but you generalized, or the prosecutor generalized and said men who pray. I mean, does this court need to give further guidance on using these artful words in describing the defendants in these cases?
Your Honor, I don't believe so. I think Your Honor is referring to two separate statements maybe made by the prosecutor. The first one that appellant takes issue with is men who sexually assault children, and then later on the word pray as a verb is used separately. And those two sentences were separate, obviously. And it's my interpretation of appellant's argument that he doesn't take issue with the term pray, but more men who sexually assault children. And appellant is claiming that testimony that came out during the state's case in chief doesn't support the inferences that the prosecutor presented in stating men who sexually assault children, yada, yada. But a case law states that the phrase men who sexually assault children, and then goes on to discuss why children disclose, if they do at all, the way they do, what affects disclosure, the dynamics of disclosure, and the dynamics of sexual abuse. Because all of those topics were discussed during the state's case in chief and appellant's case, then the prosecutor was appropriately indicating to the jury the inferences that they can make regarding men who prey on children. And in this case,
do you know of any published authority that says that that's, this is an awful pun, fair game to use those terms?
Your Honor, the prosecutorial misconduct cases that I have read are a little sparse on specific verbiage used.
Even they compared the elderly victims to a lion, and then we do have some crim sex cases, and that, I believe it's Dahl and another one. But it seems to me that there is not really any definitive statement on whether that's error or not, let alone harmless error.
Your Honor, it's my reading of the up-to-date case law on this is that
if you don't know of any published authority, that's fine. That's the only question I really have towards you, is if there's any guiding case that, and we don't want to slice and dice and say you can do this, you can't do that, but we do have some cases that are directive for prosecutors to say, you know what, you shouldn't do this and avoid using the we words and things of that nature.
Your Honor, I can't think off the top of my head of particular case law that says prosecutors can't use the verb pray or discuss men who sexually assault children in general.
Counsel.
And I think that's
I'm sorry, finish.
And I think that's because clearly in these child sex abuse cases, you have experts testifying regarding the dynamics of disclosure and the dynamics of sexual abuse generally. And so to say men who sexually assault children and then explain those things, explain the proper influences, the proper inferences that a jury could make, those are proper statements. And to eliminate the word pray as a verb that prosecutors can say is far overbroad and should not be the rule in this case.
Do you agree, though, that this same introduction to the closing argument has been used almost verbatim in other cases that are currently on appeal at this court?
According to the transcripts, yes.
Okay. And is there any evidence in the record that shows that the defendant in this case chose these children because he thought he could get away with it?
Can you repeat that, Your Honor?
Well, there's one of the sentences in the general introduction is, men who prey upon children do so because they think they can get away with it. Is there any evidence to show that that statement is related to the specific facts of this case?
Yes, Your Honor. Specifically, the corner house experts, Mr. Konkar and the medical doctor, they all describe how dynamics of sexual abuse affect a child's dynamics of disclosure, if they do disclose at all. That was the whole foundation laid prior to Mr. Konkar and the medical doctor describing how OS and US disclosed in this case. That is why it's proper for the prosecutor to include those statements in their closing. It is a proper inference for the jury to make, and that is an important part.
But this statement is about men who pray generally, not about this specific defendant, correct?
The statement does read, men who sexually assault children and pray is used separately. I don't recall the exact sentence of pray, but the statement does say men who sexually assault children, and that's not an inaccurate statement based on the testimony that came in and the facts of that particular case. Additionally, Your Honor, I would just like to again state...
But I'm sorry. Why isn't that an attempt to appeal to the passion and prejudice of the jury? I mean, it seems to me it's pretty inflammatory language.
Well, Your Honor, it's not an inaccurate statement to say men who sexually assault children do so in exploiting all the reasons why there's various dynamics of disclosure of child sex abuse victims. If Your Honor would prefer men and women who sexually assault children, it's already close enough to men who sexually assault children. I don't see much of a difference at all between using those two phrases. I don't see another alternative. People, some gender-neutral term.
I see lots of alternatives, quite frankly. I think you can talk about the dynamics of disclosure. I mean, I think much of this argument is fine if you relate to the children. You know, children are easily frightened or persuaded into silence. Children can be confused about the appropriate parent caregiver role. Children are going to be uncomfortable using terms. Children, you know, I mean, to me, it's the way it's presented. And I think the claim here is that it inflames the passions of the jury by not talking about the children's dynamics. I mean, I argued the State v. Hall case to the Minnesota Supreme Court back in the 1980s, where they allowed the use of the dynamics of abuse. There's no dispute about that. I think it's turning it around and talking generally about men who pray that creates the emotional reaction. You know, I think more artfully, this whole argument just about comes in. You talk about the dynamics of disclosure, and you sum it up with, that's why children are the perfect victim. I know there would be an objection to that too, but we're not talking about men who prey on these. We're concentrating on the dynamics of disclosure, and it seems to me maybe that's where this argument strays a bit.
And even if that is the case, Your Honor, a case law clearly states that an isolated statement or word, it's improper for this court to emphasize that. This court has to emphasize the entire argument as a whole, whether or not that constitutes prosecutorial misconduct. And even if so, the only way appellant is entitled to reversal is if they can show prejudice. And clearly, any jury instruction ameliorated those concerns. Again, the prosecutor's statements were brief, unobjected to, ameliorated by the curative instruction. The other evidence was strong in this case. Appellant was entitled to rebut any statements made by the prosecutor in her closing. And I understand I'm out of time, so unless Your Honors have additional questions, I will ask that this court affirm.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Cornell. Mr. Butler.
Thank you. I want to start with Judge Cochran's question about isn't this conduct, the misconduct, designed to appeal to the passions and prejudices of the jury? And I think the answer is clearly yes, and I think we know that because this is a scripted, ahead-of-time argument distributed to prosecutors in this office, and they are advised, clearly advised, to make it in these cases. This was not written by this prosecutor. Having heard the evidence here, she didn't go home that night and write her closing. We know that this is because either it's massive coincidence that the same words are used in a bunch of these child sex cases.
Well, I think we know that the same words are used, but the problem that you're facing as a defender is that it's used fleetingly in isolation, and you get to the ultimate question, how did it prejudice your defendant? I don't know if we're at a point where there needs to be some decisive determination as to whether that is fair game or not.
Well, Your Honor, I'm going to disagree with the phrase fleetingly or in isolation. It is the entire theme of the closing. It is the beginning, middle, and end of the main closing.
Of course, the jurors are instructed that the words of the attorneys are not evidence. And
sure, that's true in every prosecutorial misconduct case. So in every prosecutorial misconduct case, including the reversals, juries are instructed that the words of the prosecutor are not evidence. That's not a carte blanche for the prosecutor to say what she wants, nor is it a card for this court to use to say, well, we don't have to do anything about it because the jury got this general instruction from the district court. We recognize that juries...
In your opinion, do you think that the theme that you have described, if the theme was strong enough, that it would deserve some... directive by this court as to whether or not that should be stricken from the vocabulary and the argument?
Absolutely, yes, Your Honor. I would suggest that, including because this is not the only time this argument has been made. I agree. Sometimes misconduct arguments are, oop, you said pray, somewhere on the middle of a 30-page closing, I'm going to stand up because I don't have anything else to say in this appeal. I'm going to stand up and say that was misconduct. I agree that happens sometimes. No, that's not this case. I'm sorry, Your Honor, I don't mean to interrupt you.
No, that's all right. I didn't mean to interrupt you, but... In some sense, I think your argument would be stronger, and I'm not saying it's strong enough. Don't put any relative weight on this question. But in some sense, I think your argument might be stronger if anybody was objecting to this. I mean, we keep hearing that this is coming before us time and time again, yeah. And nobody seems to be concerned about it from the defender's point of view at the trial stage.
You know, I agree.
So we're here on plain error, and having sat where the judge sat there for 18 and a half years, it's really hard for a trial judge to interrupt a closing argument, embarrass the public defender, and say, you can't do that, Mr. Prosecutor. You know, I tried it once, and I was told, you're interfering with my defense strategy, Judge.
Yeah.
So I think that makes this a hard argument.
I'd encourage the court then to look at Ramey, because I think the Ramey decision, it actually takes it out of that context. I agree that in a lot of plain error cases, in a lot of different types of errors can be framed as, should the trial judge have stepped in and done 1, 2, and 3? That's not how the misconduct plain error cases read. The misconduct plain error cases really fault the prosecutor. Unlike evidentiary errors or other things, they don't fault the trial judge for not stepping in, because I think they recognize that that's a very difficult thing for the trial judge to do. Ramey and Mahorn, but particularly Ramey, which talks about plain error, talks about how the appellate courts are tired of seeing this from prosecutors. They're not chastising. The Supreme Court's not chastising the trial bench for not getting more involved. They're chastising the prosecutors. And so the onus here is on the prosecutor to not commit misconduct in the first place, not on the trial judge to either step in or not step in and deal with it. And so I think the answer to Judge Warkey's question is yes, this court should step in now and say, you can't say this stuff. Because it's not tied to the facts of the case. I know it's not tied to the facts of the case because it was written way before this trial ever happened.
Are you familiar with Cheney, in which this court said that it was problematic to use that reference as predator, but it was not plain error given the facts? It's an unpublished case.
Not particularly, Your Honor. But I would say the problem here is a little bit less on the precise verbiage and on the generalness of the argument, on the evocativeness of the argument. Whether it's prey or animal or some other word isn't really the point. The point is it's about men generally, not the defendant, and it's not tied to the evidence in the case.
Do you agree, I know you're out of time, but I'll ask you to answer this question.
Sure.
Do you agree that much of what's in the objected to and quoted portions of the argument, if done a different way in terms of the disclosure issues that children have and testimony in the case that support it, would be fair argument?
I think that's probably true, but I think you'd have to change it quite a bit, Your Honor. And I think you can't. I don't think you can just excise the sentences that start with men or the defendant and then say, okay, well, the rest of this is proper. Of course it's proper, if I may finish the thought.
Go ahead.
Of course it's proper for the prosecutor in a case where there's expert testimony about children's disclosures and the patterns of disclosure and delayed disclosure to get up in front of the jury and say, you heard that expert witness tell you about children's disclosures and the patterns of disclosure. That's fine. Would never complain about that. There's evidence in the record of that. This argument is not about the children. It's about the defendant. And it's not even about the defendant. It's about men generally, men who prey on children generally. That is not proper, not only because there's no evidence of it. There's no evidence about men who prey on children in the record. It would be improper if there was, because we're talking about this defendant and this burden in this case.
Thank you,
Your Honors.
Yeah, thank you, Ms. Cornell. The court obviously has your briefs, and we appreciate those and your arguments here today. And we'll take the matter under advisement, and we will have a decision for you in 90 days. This is our last oral matter here today, so we stand adjourned.
Nick.
Nick, I need to come to Jerry's office.
Excellent. Yeah.